Hey folks, welcome to episode 307 of the MLF Bass Fishing Podcast in Shaftesbury, Vermont. I'm Jody White, joined, as always, from Norwalk, Iowa, by the one and only Kyle Wood.
Yeah, we're back.
Kyle, it's been like a really long time. Some of that has been because of technical difficulties. Some of that has just been because there's a lot going on.
Yep.
But there's not anything going on now. We're done for a while.
Settled down. Yeah, it has settled down.
Which, thank goodness, because I'm not done following tournaments for the year. Like, I'm still interested in tournaments, but I am not interested to work any more of them. I'm not interested to, really put a lot of effort into any more tournaments this year. I feel like I've hit a plateau.
Yeah. I don't blame you. I don't blame you one bit.
We'll banter a little, and the main thing I want to talk about is, does it feel like fall yet? Because it feels like fall right here, man, and I'm loving it.
Ooh, it actually, we finally got a little cool down here in Iowa, and it definitely feels like fall. Like, the other night, it got down to like 44. And when I went outside the next morning to let Suze out, oh my goodness. Yes. It's everything I wanted.
The highs for next week, starting on Sunday in Vermont, 66, 65, 65, 62,
oh
66.
My gorgeous.
66. All next week, baby.
Gorgeous.
I'm not gonna sweat once next week.
Dude, that is, I hope you are fishing. We just got done talking about before this podcast, a little bit of work that we got to do, but I hope you are fishing most every one of those days.
We've got to do some work, and my boat needs to get ready, which I feel like it's a really good chance it's good to go by Wednesday, let's say.
Okay.
It's having some repairs done on it, as it always is.
just a constant state of repair.
I think that, like, you know, I feel like for sure Thursday, Friday, like, I am just gone, baby.
Yeah, now we're talking.
That's my plan anyhow. but we'll see how it goes. It is always something with my boat.
Never a dull moment.
No. But anyhow, let's go ahead. Let's sell some stuff. And then we'll dive into the show. We've got an interview with Mike Trombley coming up. I did it. My audio is not perfect for it. I apologize for that, but the content is excellent. Mike has a lot of like pretty interesting things to say about smallmouth, and we introduce a new smallmouth-centric feature, which is, of course, something we do for this show, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Then we are going to wrap up some Toyota Series competition on the Potomac. We'll talk about the Toyota Series event going on at Havasu. We will probably mention and sort of give at least a brief run through the last Bass Pro Tour event at St. Clair. And then I think we'll be out of here. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's going to be a good show.
I like it. Well, in that case, Kyle, I'm just going to sell some stuff.
Give it to us.
Few lures have stood the test of time, like the original Rattle Trap by Bill Lewis. And now, with the help of Major League Fishing Pro Mark Daniels Jr., we're launching the SB57 and MR6. Go to Rattletrap.com to learn more. Are you in need of a great career opportunity that gives you time to fish and spend time with the family? Neat Companies is looking for you. Neat needs Class A CDL drivers now. Competitive pay, 100% paid health insurance, 401k, tuition reimbursement, and more are just some of the benefits. Call Neat now at 833-463-NEAT to get your career started. 833-463-NEAT. Kyle, I hope you feel influenced. I hope you are heading to rattletrap.com right now. And, I guess you might dial up Neat, but really I want to keep you around.
I appreciate it. I thought about giving him a call, but then I was like, we should finish the show.
Dude, if you were a trucker, we could probably still podcast.
Oh, 100% we could. Yeah, absolutely.
So maybe we'll keep that in mind, I guess. But anyhow, let's go ahead. We'll throw this over to Mr. Trombley.
All righty, and we are joined now by Mike Trombley from Belleville, Michigan. Longtime smallmouth angler, coming off a huge win in the Phoenix Bass Fishing League event at the Detroit River. It was a super tournament. He had 25-8 on day one, 27-6 on day two for almost 53 pounds for 2 days of smallmouth. Mike, thanks for coming on, man.
Hey, anytime, Jody. I sure appreciate you calling me. It's always a pleasure anytime we talk.
Dude, for sure. Right off the bat, like, have you weighed over 50? How many? Have you weighed over 50 pounds of smallmouth in a 2-day tournament before this? Like, I feel like you probably have, but maybe not.
I think I've been close. There was one super tournament I had a 26, 15 pound bag, and the day before, I think I was pushing 23. So I was probably a little bit shy of that. But, yeah, it's kind of a special thing when that happens. It's not every day that it comes together on a tournament day. Practice day is one thing, but when it happens on a tournament day, the good Lord's watching over you.
Yeah, that super tournament, it was 2009, right?
Yes, it was. Yep.
You had 48-14. So,
48-14, okay.
Really close. it's amazing now how regularly, like, folks will just blaze past the 25-pound-a-day mark. I mean,
yeah, it's amazing. I think our fish are getting so much bigger, and I think it's because of the gobies, no doubt. You know, the growth rate of the smallmouth has been jacked up accordingly, and it's pretty phenomenal. I don't know where the ceiling is, to be honest with you. I won't be surprised if somebody catches, you know, 30 pounds. Heath Wagner, a couple years ago, had that giant stringer on St. Clair, and it's a pretty phenomenal thing.
Yeah, no doubt. And, like, I know what I think Dobson in a team tournament, it was Dobson and Green had over 30 on St. Clair. And, like, I don't really keep track necessarily on, like, the Thousand Islands, but I would imagine that it's been done there, you know? Maybe not in a team tournament, but certainly just fishing, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I knew Kyle did. It may have happened one more time here on St. Clair. In our area of Detroit River, I've not seen it happen in a tournament or Lake Erie. But we've had it on numerous occasions practicing. It's just so hard to get that to happen during a tournament. A lot of things have to cooperate, weather especially.
Yeah, no doubt. Especially, I guess on the Great Lakes, the weather is like basically the primary factor almost all the time.
Absolutely. You know, you can't make a run someplace if you're catching them a long way away if you're dealing with 4 to 6 footers. And, you know, this past weekend we were blessed with, you know, not terrible but not real good conditions. You could get there, and there was a lot of times my trolling motor was coming out of the water as you're fishing, and you just kind of have to deal with that.
All right. Well, let's back up a little bit. You were, and I guess sort of set the scene here a bit. You have been fishing, you know, as far as I can tell, you've been fishing BFL since 2000. So for a fairly long time. I imagine you were fishing before that. Can you tell me just a little bit about yourself and then how you got into, tournament fishing? Because obviously, you know, you look at your record and you look at your record locally, like, you know, you're doing something right out there.
Yeah, you know, I have an uncle that got me started in this. My Uncle Tom, years ago when I was a kid, kind of planted that seed for me. He pretty much took me out in the pond and, you know, basically sparked that interest catching largemouths. And he and I fished a club tournament, Blue Gray Bass Club out of Toledo. And that pretty much sparked everything for me. I just kind of got a feel for what it took to largemouth and smallmouth fish. And, you know, long about, I would say it was 98. I probably started fishing a lot of team tournaments, and we started off, did very, very well, won some, came in second in a lot, and I think I fished my first one, as you said, in 2000, first BFL, and that would have been, it was the very last year of the Red Man. It was the last year that they gave away a spittoon as the prize, and I'll never forget it. I came in second in that, and from there on, it's just, I love to catch smallmouths. I could probably fish for smallmouth every day of the year, except for that golden 2 weeks that I'm deer hunting.
All right, fair enough. I feel like that's kind of the way a lot of the more hardcore smallmouth guys are, because so much of that good smallmouth fishing happens in the fall. You know, there's a lot of largemouth guys down south that they don't look at a bass, you know, once fall rolls around. And up north, that just doesn't seem to be the case for the, like, your real smallmouth addicts, you know?
Yeah, it's really hard for me. I struggle. As soon as the deer season rolls around, all of your good days for smallmouth fishing on the big pond on Erie have to be calm. And, of course, those are your best deer hunting days. So it's a struggle for me. I try to get my deer. If I can get my deer out of the way, then I'm gung-ho bass fishing. And, shoot, we catch bass probably till it ices up. That's really some of the best time.
I have caught over 20 pounds on December 26th before, so I'm with you.
That's phenomenal. And some things happen that they get ganged up in areas that you just wouldn't expect those kinds of numbers. It's brutal. I'll be honest. It's brutal to be out there. Temperatures, sometimes you are packed up with clothes. We wear float suits for the safety aspect. But, yeah, it's a lot of fun. We just love catching these smallies.
No doubt. One question I had, and I want to ask you about this most recent tournament stuff, but like you have fished enough regionally, and it seems like you might be the kind of guy that would try to fish more, either like, let's say, the Northern Division, which has lately incorporated a lot more smallmouth, or even, you know, like maybe more nationally, because you fish some pretty big stuff when it comes to you, like, you know, you've got checks back when we used to have, like, the old FLW Tour Opens and stuff like that, like on St. Clair and things like that. Do you...
Sure, those were great tournaments.
Did you ever aspire to take it national, or have you always just been content to kind of fish close to home and to, like, work an actual job and that sort of thing?
So, I've had offers to do that. I have a real close friend that's made that offer for me to do that for a couple years, and I just kind of made the choice that I wanted to cherry pick and fish the tournaments that I wanted. I'm into robotics, so we do some robotic programming, and I'm an electrician, and I really enjoy what I do. I know it's very difficult on a relationship when you're married to do that on the road, and it's just kind of a choice I've made. I would just as soon stick around and do the smallmouth thing, whether it be Champlain, Thousand Islands, New York, the Buffalo area of Erie, and then around here, of course. So that's kind of been a choice I've made. Would I go do that? I'm not to say that I wouldn't take a year and say, okay, I'm going to go do the tour. I would probably think about doing that if the conditions were right, circumstances were right. But I'm very content in what we're doing here, cherry picking the right tournaments up here in the Midwest.
Yeah, I think that fishing the tournaments that you like to fish is, like, fantastic. And it's, like, when you go out on the road, for most people, most of the time, it is not filled with, like, 100% success. Like, it is very hard, and you're going to get your teeth kicked in sometimes. And I'm sure not every tournament you crush them in, but, you know, you being able to fish back home, not having to travel, like, there's a lot of good to be said about that.
Absolutely. You know, and even on our home water, you can count on a bad tournament. It will happen. I remember a final day of an Everstart. It's been probably 15 years ago. I zeroed on that day. And so you can count on it happening. It's not fun when it does, but that's just kind of the nature of the beast.
No doubt. Let me ask right about this BFL. It was the Michigan Division. You crushed it. It went out of the Detroit River, so, you know, theoretically you had anywhere you wanted to go. You know, you could run up into St. Clair. I guess Canada was in play for you guys, I assume?
Yep, it was.
Well, tell me
about it. We could pretty much go everywhere.
How did you end up catching them? I don't need waypoints, but I'm curious. You know what I mean?
So, basically, everything I caught was on a drop shot. I caught a couple on a tube, and I guess I had one fish that I caught on a swim bait when I came back to the river. But most of what I was fishing was really deep. It was pushing 30 feet, and there are places that They're little transitions from sand to gravel to rock, you know, some little high spots. And basically what I practiced, you know, I caught one or two fish off each one of these spots, and I did not sit in one specific spot and catch all my fish. There was no mother lode, so there's no misconception there. I just kind of covered water and had enough places that I could catch one or two or maybe three and then get out of there and head to the next place. A little milk run, if you will.
And basically every time you stopped, every time you caught one, it was a big one for 2 days in a row.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. The first place, I leaned on a spot pretty heavy the first day, and I think I had a limit before I left it, and I probably had about maybe 24 or 24 and a half pounds, and slid over to another area and caught another real big one. But I think I had, I was thinking back here, I think I had three or four over six over the course of the 2 days there. With the final day, I had that 6.12, and then I had a 6.25. So, yeah, it was good. Most of the places that I'm fishing, they're deep, and I think the fish that I'm catching, at this time of year, you get an influx of shad. You know, the shad are trying to move off from the middle of the lake. I think throughout the summertime, most of our fish are very nomadic. That's why some of these fish, like your six-pounders, you're just simply not seeing on most of the structure, because I think they're following those schools. And, you know, I'm hearing that from most guys that I talk to, whether it be Ontario or the Buffalo side of Erie. Our fish are becoming so nomadic because the schools are not staying put unless they're on gobies. And the fish that I was catching were regurgitating shad. So obviously they're fish that probably pulled off the lake, and the shad came to the areas where I was, and I was fortunate enough to get onto the areas, you know, where the shad pulled to.
When you fish these areas and found them in practice, like, would you, I'm assuming a lot of these are history places, you know, it's a seam that you found at some point in time, or it's a transition you found some point in time. Like, you probably didn't find a lot of like brand new stuff in practice for this one. Maybe you did, but like when you would idle over it, or when you would pull up on it in practice, would you idle it? Would you see fish? Would you see shad? Would you pull up and fish it to see it? Would you see them on forward facing sonar? Like, how does that interplay work for you? Because to me anyway, I always feel like there are a lot of situations where it can be really hard to mark smallmouth on your electronics compared to, like, you know, that classic, beautiful Kentucky Lake ledge screenshot, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yep, sure does. Yeah, and this time of year, I've noticed over the years that most of our smallmouth are tight to the bottom. So when you idle over top of them, it's very difficult to see. A lot of what you're seeing is just a thickening of the bottom, a little lump on the bottom, if you will, kind of like a little half moon. So basically, I'll cycle through and I'll fish those areas. When you look at them on live scope, you have to entice those fish to pull off that bottom. And a lot of times, I would typically just catch one or two in practice, one, maybe two, and then the rest of the time is strictly graphing them. I'll graph them and see what else is there. It'll tell me whether or not there's a load on a spot or whether or not I'm just dealing with a fish or two.
When you say graph them, you mean looking at them like on 2D, or do you mean like you'll pull one off the bottom on Panoptics and you'll be like, all right, there's 10 with it, I'm good, or something like that? Does that make sense?
It's a little bit of both, for sure. I'll graph it idling. There's a lot of places, Jody, that I will go to, and I may just graph it 2D, just running the motor over top of it, and if I don't see what I'm looking for, I keep going. If it's a place I have really good history with and a lot of confidence, then I'll drop a trolling motor and I'll look at them with live scope and, you know, just see what's there. I might toss a couple drop shots on there to see if I can pull something off the bottom. But, it's typically 100% graphing. So many places I won't even fish unless I graph them there.
Okay. It makes sense. And, like, when you think about the scale of the Great Lakes, and one, maybe the mapping is really great in your neck of the woods, but a lot of the Great Lakes mapping I've seen is really not that good. And then two, it's just a vast area when you take it all together. I mean, it seems like staying on your main motor is such a good strategy for like finding fish and breaking things down.
Absolutely. Yeah, and anything that's on the mapping has probably been found and probably has a lot of pressure to it. So kind of keep that in mind. And that I think is true no matter what body of water you're on. So your time behind the seat of your boat, idling around, that's probably the time that I found 99.9% of things. And now when you throw in the live scope shows you just a little bit extra. So it's a special thing, that live scope, being able to see forward of you. And even the panoptics, you know, when you're looking at the perspective view can show you so much more.
Yeah, tell me about that, because you're obviously, you know, you're an electronically savvy guy. It sounds like you're at least are for your job. And I know that doesn't always translate one way or the other, but when did you get forward-facing sonar? And, like, do you feel like it's changed the way you fish a lot? Or has it just made you better? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think with anybody that's savvy with their electronics and does a lot of their work with 2D sonar is going to be able to use forward-facing sonar with ease. You know, what you're seeing ahead of you, you don't have to get on top of a fish and have a sonar, you know, blaring on top of their head. With the forward-facing sonar, you know, you can tickle them with the forward view and pitch to them and maybe not educate that fish as much as you would if you were up on top of them. It's pretty incredible what the forward-facing sonar does for you.
When did you first get it? Like, have you been doing it for 3, 4, 5 years? I just got it last year? What was your education process?
So mine was last year. It was pre-COVID, and a good buddy of mine went up north. I installed it, and I fished a couple places down here, and it just so happened when COVID hit, we were off work for, you know, a couple months there. I work at a place that we make the Gladiator Jeep truck. So when everything got shut down, I went up north into, I call it Glory Land. It's heaven for smallmouth fishing up in northern Michigan. And it was amazing, so many fish that I could see on that thing sitting out in front of me and either toss a swim bait, a drop shot, a jerk bait. And it was incredible what you could catch. So I kind of translated that back here to St. Clair, Detroit River, in Lake Erie, and it shows you a pretty decent amount if you take the time to learn it. There's a lot of people I know that I've talked to that are frustrated with it, but I think they're trying to make too much out of it than what it is. It's as much about seeing structure as it is the fish themselves.
Yeah, I could see that, because like there are times I feel like with every additional piece of technology, like, you get to see a higher percentage of the fish, right? So, like, let's say maybe with 2D, you can see 20% of the fish. And I'm kind of just pulling the percentages out. Well, maybe with panoptics or live scope, you know, maybe you're up to, like, I don't know, 60% of the fish, 70% of the fish. But you're still not seeing them all.
Yeah.
You know?
And then throw in the factor of being able to tell what they are. If you can get yourself to a point where you can tell that they're bass and whether they're sheephead, you know, that's a giant thing. Because there's so many reefs here. Our sheephead population has skyrocketed.
It's in great shape. Right? Based on my time at Sandusky, the sheephead population in Western Erie is just phenomenal.
It is incredible. I wish we could get the commercial fishing guys to catch those and kind of decrease their numbers for us. And maybe they do. You know, I don't know. Maybe they sell them as walleye. It's hard to tell. But, yeah, if you can tell the difference between the two, you're definitely a leg up on the competition. But you can't always do that. If it's rough and you have a trolling motor that's coming out of the water, it's extremely difficult to distinguish what that is, whether you're dealing with a smallmouth or a large or a sheephead.
What are some of the tells between smallmouth and sheep's head?
So a lot of it's probably shape. You know, you get a little bit more of an arch if you just look at the body shape of a sheephead. He has a lot more of an arch to him, and their body language tells you a lot. The smallmouth tend to move a little bit more with purpose, and you don't get quite that with the sheephead. They're a little bit more pneumatic, I would say.
Don't they?
They do wander, yeah. Absolutely.
What about walleye? Because I've recently noticed there's more walleye than I thought there were on Lake Champlain. And I have not really... let's put it this way. I have been very fooled a number of times and fished quite a bit longer than I should have for walleye that I couldn't get to bite that I thought were smallmouth I couldn't get to bite.
Okay. See, that I'm not sure of yet. I have looked at some of the walleyes, and they mark very, very similar to bass. There are a lot of straight line marks. But I haven't fished enough places, at least in my places, I haven't had them to where...
You don't have a mix.
They're in such a number where it's a problem.
Fair enough.
In other words, where there's all walleyes and no smallmouths, I haven't had that issue yet.
I think that
I do use it for my walleye fishing, though.
Yeah, I think that can happen more on, like, more of the east end of Erie, like out by Buffalo. Like, I got a buddy out there. I think he runs into that, like, a fair amount. And his gauge on it is that he says if it looks too good to be true, they're probably walleye and not bass.
Okay. That's a good way to look at it. I'll keep that in mind.
Just because they can group up so much. At the same time, I worry about that because, like, almost the basis of fishing on the Great Lakes is that you're going to run into more times where the smallmouth fishing is too good to be true than, like, anywhere else in the country. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've had some mega load schools where you've had, I couldn't tell you how many are in some of these schools, and really pre-algae for the Western Basin, it seemed like I could get schools that there had to have been 100 fish in a school. Just insane. And it's not deep either. But anymore, since we've had the algae, I'm not seeing that happening. We're dealing with a lot more smaller schools for sure.
All right. One other question I wanted to ask, and I want to talk about that Major League Fishing, that Bassport Tour event, because I know you probably paid attention to it. But you mentioned earlier that the fish you were catching in your BFL win were eating shad. And it's amazing to me that, one, the smallmouth are getting so big, and it seems almost for sure that gobies are a major part of it. But they're also not, like, solely eating gobies. Like, they will obviously eat a lot of other things. What's your opinion on that? Do you think they switch throughout the years? Do you think they follow certain types of bait around? Like, why doesn't just every smallmouth in the lake eat a goby?
Well, I think it's availability. I think, especially on St. Clair, I think we have situations where the smallmouths come in such a school that I think they wipe out everything that is there. And I think most of the guys on St. Clair will agree with me that your goby population on St. Clair is not the same. It used to be a lot, but I think everything has kind of dropped off here now where you're dealing more with the shed, your perch,
yeah.
Alewives, and... You know, it's all a matter of, you know, your fall time, everything becomes shad-oriented. And because they're in such schools and they tend to pull shallow from off the middle of the lake, I think that's why we see more of a focus on that. You mentioned the MLF. I'm sure those guys were catching those fish because of schools of shad. I think if you ask any one of them, they probably were seeing lots of birds in areas, and that probably meant there was pretty good school of shad in that area.
That's an interesting theory about the smallmouth, like, just wiping things out, and, like, it kind of makes some sense, because, like, if you think about it, gobies look very easy to eat. You know, they can't swim away very fast, they can't go up and down in the water column, like, they're kind of just there, whereas,
right.
You know, perch and shad, like, if there's a lot of smallmouth in an area, they could leave, you know, they can go somewhere else, more effectively.
Absolutely, they don't have a swim bladder. So they're not able to suspend, you know, like your shad or anything else does.
Yeah, that's neat.
Easy pickings on the bottom.
All right. Well, I guess my other question was, you know, for that Bass Pro Tour event, were you surprised to see largemouth play as much as they did? That one day where Morgan had a really big day, if his best five largemouth would have been over 25 pounds. Like, he cracked them. And, like, Wesley never really caught big ones, but he still caught a ton of them. Like, did that largemouth aspect of the event surprise you at all, or did it kind of feel like it was something that should have happened given the format, given the conditions, you know?
Yeah, so given the format, and first of all, my hats go off to Andy Morgan and Wesley Strader. They did an exceptional job on the largemouth. But did it surprise me? No. The thing that surprised me was probably the size of the bag that Andy had. That was pretty incredible. You know, once you break 25 with a sack of largemouths, that's not easy to do. I would say anywhere in the country that's dealing with northern strain largemouths. The other half of that, as far as the numbers, it did not. You know, we've had days where we've caught 100 largemouths in places. It's just the format lends itself to that style of fishing to be able to do well. And, you know, of course, if they can catch a 2-pounder, everything is scoreable. So in that way, that did not surprise me at all. Yeah, it's we have a pretty incredible fishery here for both largemouth and smallmouth. But with most of what we're dealing with, where you have a 5-fish format, the largemouths tend to not play. Now, Andy Stringer, that may change that in the future. We'll see how many guys do that.
Yeah. If there's a guy out there who can figure out how to catch 25 pounds of largemouth on a regular basis or semi-regular basis, like, that would be interesting. You know, 25 yeah. pounds is just interesting all the time.
That'd be pretty dangerous.
Yeah, no doubt. What about the areas they fished? Obviously, like, you know, Neal won over in that, let's say, Rivermouth or Erie area. You know, Dobson was down in there a bunch. Wheeler was in there a bunch. Do you think it would have changed a lot if they had been able to go into Canada? Would St. Clair have played a lot more? Would somewhere else in Erie have played a lot more? Or do you think that just the time of year just made that the place to be no matter what?
If they would have opened up Canada, you would have seen a lot more people spread out. And I would say many, many more people would have been in Canada for sure. When you lock into the American side, it kind of, you know, it doesn't, you would think that it wouldn't matter with the volume of water that we have, but it really does, especially on St. Clair. I think, you know, the amount of pressure that we've had because of COVID and Canada being closed for the last year, there's been a ton of pressure on that Canadian or on the American side. And I've got to believe a lot of those fish have slipped over to Canada. So yeah, I think it's probably made a big deal, you know, being locked into the American side there for sure.
Do you think they would have been over in Canada in Erie or over in Canada up in St. Clair? Just because I know, like, you know, for a few years, St. Clair was like as hot as it could be, you know, especially in the summertime. You know, it seemed like we would have a tournament there, and in years past, a lot of guys would, you know, run from St. Clair all the way through the Detroit River, all the way out a long way into Erie. You know, you might have got checks doing that. And it seems like the last few years, St. Clair was the place to be. Do you think it's shifted a little bit, or what's your vibe?
No, I think it's still the same. You know, St. Clair deals so much more in schools, whereas Erie, you know, you're a good school on Erie, I'm going to say, is 5 to 10 fish if you pull up to a spot. If you can catch 5 to 10 fish off of a spot, you've got a high-level spot. On St. Clair, if you pull up to a spot, gosh, you might catch, you know, 20, 30, 40 fish if you're on one of the good schools. That's why I think probably not so much on the Lake Erie side as far as Canada goes if they were able to fish it. I think it probably would have been more so, you know, in Canadian waters of St. Clair.
Okay. Is there anything about that event that, like, particularly surprised you or impressed you, you know, I guess maybe outside of the Andy Morgan just killing it that one day?
Yeah, probably just the number of fish that were caught on St. Clair after all the magnitude of pressure it's been having for the last year. You know, those guys did a fantastic job. You know, they're fantastic fishermen. Their ability to find things over the average guy is pretty phenomenal with their electronics. That's what sets them, I think, ahead of most guys. My hats are off to them.
Cool. Good deal. Well, I like it, and I appreciate the insight because I feel like any time a local pays, like, pretty close attention to a big tournament, there's some stuff that they'll know and they'll be glad that didn't get discovered. And then there's also some stuff that, you know, they know, and maybe it wouldn't have worked for that kind of tournament or that time of year. But usually there's like one or two things that either you learn or you just kind of file away and say, man, that's interesting. I wonder, I'll need to try that, or I'll need to investigate that at some point in time. So I like the local breaking down, you know, big events. I know I always mentally do that whenever, you know, there's a big tournament at Champlain or something. So I like that.
Yeah, there's always a takeaway, you know, where the big ones got caught that everybody else didn't get onto, being local. That's always a neat thing.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, anyway, if you are ready to go, I've got kind of a rapid fire list of smallmouth related questions, and I figured I would just go down them, and you can answer in as much or as little detail as you like, and we will leave it at that. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
All right. Well, tell me, what's the biggest one you've ever caught?
So my largest is 7.6. I've been fortunate enough to catch 3 over 7, and 7.6 is the biggest one.
Golly. I am still really trying to catch a 7. I have stopped worrying too much about 6-pounders. I love catching them, but I'm not counting. But man, do I want to catch a 7. That is incredible.
So I've had 4 different 7s, 7-plus-pounders caught with me before I ever caught a 7-pounder. I had 2 really good friends from Oklahoma City come up and fish with me. I'm going to say it was probably around 2008. Mike Drain and Leo Osborne, they came up, and both of those guys, we took a trip down east. And when I say down east, I'm talking east of Sandusky. And we kind of went there specifically for a shot at a big one. And Mike's first cast of the day was a 7.6. Incredible. And then at the end of the day, we made a pass back through there to see if we'd catch one more, and Leo caught a 7 even. It was pretty incredible.
On the one hand, I bet that was, pretty great, you know, to bring your buddies up and have them catch 7-pounders. On the other hand, I bet you really would have liked to have caught one of those.
It would have been nice. At that time, I'd never caught one. You know, it's the way it happens. There's so much luck with getting it in front of the right fish. But it all changes, you know. When it's your time, it's your time. You just gotta be patient.
No doubt. All right. This is this could be in a tournament or just fun fishing. What's the biggest 5-fish smallmouth bat you've ever caught?
The biggest 5-fish, personally or as a boat?
Well, I'll take personally, either answer.
Personally, it was 29.5, and I caught that this past spring. That was a St. Clair stringer. It was when the water was still really cold, and I was waiting for a buddy of mine, Mark Modrak. He had a business meeting that he had to attend, and I ended up catching a 29.5-pound stringer. And the biggest fish of the day that I had, which was way bigger than anything that I had that day landed, I caught it. And I had it at the side of the boat, and I reached for my scale to fire my scale up so I didn't have the fish in out of the water for a long time. And when I reached to grab that fish, it did a little easy roll and came off. And that fish was way bigger than any of the 6.5s that I had that day.
Well, I tell you what, 29.5 is, regardless, absolutely gigantic.
It was a super day. We had a lot of fun. Mark came then and joined me, and we had a big time.
Cool. What's your favorite time of year to smallmouth fish?
So I would say probably the fall. You know, once that water gets down around 40 degrees, that is probably my favorite time. Because they get ganged up in very small areas. And if the weather is good and your water clarity stays good, you can catch them. If the water clarity gets bad, then we're pretty much out of luck.
All right.
But that would have to be my favorite. That's probably that November, anywhere from the 1st of November all the way to Christmas. That's probably the best time, because typically somewhere around Christmas, our water gets hard and you can't fish it.
What is your favorite technique? And this might roll right in with your favorite time of year.
My favorite technique. Well, let me think about that. I love the power fish. That is probably my favorite. I love catching them any way that I can. But if I had to pick a technique, it'd probably be a swim bait. so many big giants have come on that swim bait. I had one big one in this past VFL Super Tournament on a swim bait. I stopped at a eelgrass patch at the mouth there and caught a big one. But if I had to pick one where I can catch a fish on that any time of the year, it'd have to be a swim bait for sure.
Now, are you fishing that a variety of ways? Like, is this a, well, you answered swim bait and you got every kind of swim bait, or is this a particular, like a big swim bait through the water column, something like that? Like, what's your, do you have a category
on
that?
It depends what time of year it is, because typically, you know, in the cold water time of the year, they typically like a smaller swim bait, like a 3-3 Kytec, something small like that. And then as the water warms and you're dealing with fish in a, you know, a summertime pattern or a springtime pattern, then it's probably a 3-8 Kytec, something a little bit bigger.
I like it. Let's see. Next up, what's your favorite fishery?
Bar none, Lake Ontario. I love what we have here, but I think because I've been here for so long, you do tend to get a little bored with things just because you're dealing with the same places all the time. Lake Ontario has so much. If I started fishing that place every day for the rest of my life, I don't think I could find everything.
All right. Do you have a particular favorite end of Ontario? Because, I mean, they're big lakes.
Yeah, it'd be Thousand Islands end. Yeah. And when I say Lake Ontario, that's got to include Thousand Islands. That river system, it's just phenomenal.
It really is. It's a, they, that whole, like, deep current aspect of smallmouth fishing is so unique from the rest of smallmouth fishing that it's almost its whole thing, and it's really, like, actually fantastic. But then the fact that that river, like, great, you can catch them in 40 feet. Well, at the same time, you can catch a 6-pounder in, like, 5 feet of water that day, you know?
Yeah, it's just amazing. And I like doing both. Yeah. I love the sight fishing there, and I love, you know, doing the deep bite for sure. Erie's kind of the same way when it comes to you can get them shallow and deep, and so much of the deep, like Ontario, and I think most guys will tell you this, it fishes like a river, and so does Lake Erie. You know, you have to pay so much attention to what that current's doing. It dictates where it sets those fish up on different pieces of structure.
All right. I guess the next question is kind of open to your interpretation, but what's the worst smallmouth bait?
Did you say the worst?
Yeah. Or maybe even just what's a smallmouth bait that you hate? It could be, you know, you could say, well, a frog, they don't catch smallmouth very much. Or you could be like, well, you know what? People throw tubes. I hate tubes. I'll take whatever you got.
I'm going to think on that one. I love everything I catch smallmouths on. The worst.
My answer would be tubes. I know they work great, but I just do not catch fish on tubes. I'll catch them on a drop shot. I'll catch them on a Ned rig. You know, I'll catch them on a football jig. I don't catch them on tubes. But
That's a tough question, because I think most all of it, you catch them on at one time or another. You know, they have a specific time that they're effective. Gosh, I like to throw them. I like to catch them on just about everything. So let's just say this. For the sake of the fish that tend to get off, let me say rattle trap. I'll throw a rattle trap. I love to catch them on a rattle trap, don't get me wrong. But when it comes to a tournament situation, that is probably the number one bait that I have that they'll throw.
All right. You walked right into my next question. Tell me about a lost fish that you remember.
Oh, gosh. So I will say without a doubt it was the one from this spring when I had 29.5 pounds. That would have to be it for sure.
Just because it was so big.
Because that fish, yeah, that fish would have put me probably, whether it would have been the biggest fish I've ever had, it definitely has a possibility, but the stringer would have probably been over 31 pounds. So, yeah, that fish alone would probably be the one that stands out the most as far as a big fish loss.
All right. I'm going to put a vote in favor for a net on this one, because if he just sort of dipped him in a net real quick, that would have probably, you probably would have got him.
I would have. I'm not good at using a net. I typically, you know, grab everything off the side of the boat. And I don't like to use a net if I don't have to. I don't think it's good on their slime coat, for one. So basically, if I can't hoist it, and most of those big ones you can't, I'll just catch them alongside the boat there.
You've got a 522D, right?
I do. Yeah.
I don't think my arms aren't long enough to mess with that.
Yeah, and mine aren't either from the front of the boat. It always comes from the driver's side or sitting in the passenger seat or something.
Fair enough, fair enough. Who do you think the best smallmouth angler is?
Jacob Wheeler, bar none. Yeah, Jacob Wheeler.
That's true.
With what he has done, he processes things so fast, and I have a lot of respect for him. I mean, we have a lot of local guys here. If I were to name off local guys that I think are spectacular, Heath Wagner, spectacular. And of course, you know, Steve, without saying anybody's name, Steve Clapper will come to mind. He's a close friend and an incredible fisherman. And, I would say if we were talking drop shot, I would say Jared Rohde, bar none.
All right. This is a side note, but do you know if Clapper still uses a swivel for his drop shot leaders? Because I heard that he did,
you know,
and it just seems, it seems unbelievable.
It's something that I do.
Really?
I have, you know, for probably 10 or 15 years. Absolutely. Whether Steve is or not, I think he does, but I'm not positive on that. That's a good question. I would have to ask him.
So when you tie a drop shot, or maybe when you tie all of your leaders, you tie a braid to a swivel?
Yes.
Right,
so basically,
cool.
I'm fluorocarbon. I have fluorocarbon from the hook to my swivel, and that's probably a foot and a half. And then whatever my drop is from the hook to the drop shot, that's fluorocarbon as well. And then I tie my braid to the swivel. Yep.
So these FG knots, you know, I guess, like, you know, guys rolling with 8, 10, 12 foot long leaders, you're not interested. That's interesting.
Not
That's
at
cool.
all. That thing spins so much. You end up with so much line twist. And I don't know. I guess you could say results speak for themselves. If it was an issue, we wouldn't be catching them. And we are. We're not having any trouble catching them. And I'm catching them in gin clear water. If I know I'm fishing a fishery like, let's say, Thousand Islands, I may extend that section of the fluorocarbon from the swivel to the hook, just so they're not looking at as much of the braid. But is it a problem? Absolutely not.
All right. I am probably not going to stop tying leaders, but I'm intrigued, and I'm not going to discount it because obviously it works. I mean, you just caught 50 pounds in 2 days. It works.
And the ability to do a pre-rig is, I think, a huge thing as well. You save so much time if you have a rig that's already set up. I don't have to tie a braid to fluoro knot. All I'm doing is simply tying to a swivel. And I did several times throughout the day, you know, throughout those 2 days of the tournament, where, you know, you just tie that right up, just like you would a fishing, any other fishing lure.
Yeah, and you
and
have
you're pre-rigged
like,
your...
How many do you pre-rig? Like probably 5 or 10 every day? Or?
So I'm set up a little bit different for a small bait versus, you know, a fluke style bait, a little different hooks than that. So I probably have a dozen of each tied up before every tournament.
Do you like wrap them around like a pool noodle or something? Or what do you use to like keep them all organized?
So I am using, I think it was made by Lindy back in the day. And it's basically a crawler harness, you know, wrap. It looks similar to a pool noodle, except it's full of Velcro. And the one side of the Velcro, the soft side of the Velcro, is what you're wrapping around. And they give you a cutoff piece of, you know, the opposite side of the Velcro to hold everything in place. Yeah, it works very well. I've probably been doing that for 20 years.
Okay.
Ever since drop shotting came out, I've been doing that.
I'm going to have to look that thing up because I sort of have an image in my head of what it looks like. And honestly, I'm not sure I'm imagining it right, but it sounds pretty cool. Sounds like it worked pretty well.
I'll have to take a picture and send it to you.
Beautiful. All right. What do you think the best underrated smallmouth bait is?
Best underrated. Is that a technique or a specific bait?
Well, you can go either way.
I'm going to go with a technique, and I'm going to say a Carolina rig.
All right. I like it. I think that's
a
really good answer.
I think it's been a little bit forgotten.
People hate Carolina rigs. They catch a ton of fish.
Right.
All right. And then what do you think the lightest line and then the heaviest line are that you've ever caught a smallmouth on?
So So the lightest for me would have been 6 pound. I've had times when they've been really finicky, I've dropped down to 6. And the heaviest, I would say, I really don't go over 15. You know, even on an Alabama rig, you know, I'll throw that on 15-pound test. I do use 20-pound occasionally, but 15-pound, you know, it will definitely do the job. You just can't reef on it as hard. But that's about the most.
Cool. I like it. I think that if you had, like, fished on the Mississippi River some or something like that, you could have been able to get away with, like, a 50-pound on a frog or something like that. But, yeah, I mean, 15 sure. is a good answer. That's legit. I'm with you.
So I do use braid, and I guess I should take a look at that question again.
Because for topwater, you might use, like, 40 or 50. Like that, yeah.
Yeah, I'm 50 or 60 for braid on topwater. Yep.
All right. Fair enough. I'm glad we've got all the maybe I need to ask that the next person I ask it to. Maybe I need to, you know, ask it more specifically. What's your heaviest fluoro or mono? What's your heaviest braid? And really give them the full picture, you know?
Yeah, there you go. Yep.
Well, anyway, Mike, I think I have got everything I need. I've taken up, like, almost an hour of your time right now, which is incredible. It's been a blast. Is there anything you want to plug or promote or anything you want to say? It's your time, basically.
Well, if I can promote a few sponsors here, I'd love to promote More Boats from Ligonier, Indiana, Mike Broge from Mike's RX Baits, Shimano, and G. Loomis, two of my rod and reel sponsors. And that's probably about it. Send a big shout out to them. You know, appreciate it. Without them, you know, it's hard to do what we do. Our sponsors definitely push us along.
No doubt.
And, of course, our family. Our family is incredible. You know, we can't do what we do without our family. I have a lovely wife, Dina, that is very supporting in what we do, what I do, and it's a lot of fun. We can't do it without them.
Well, Mike,
and a shout out to the Lord.
That is all good stuff, man. I appreciate it. And
thank you. I appreciate you thinking of me.
Dude, it is no problem. And thanks so much for coming on. Thanks for dropping a ton of smallmouth knowledge. And good luck the rest of this year, I guess, in the woods and on the water.
First up, we should hit on the conclusion of the Northern Division. It was at my second home, the Potomac River. obviously, great place to be. The fishing was actually pretty good the first 2 days, and then it was terrible the final day, as predicted. Thomas Wooten came away with the win. He's from Virginia. He had 12-12 on day one. He had 18 pounds on day two, which was huge. And then he had 14-6 on day three, won by a pretty narrow margin over Aaron Dixon, who had 17-1 on day one, 15-3 on day two, and then only 12 pounds on the final day. Kyle, do you have any topics on that you want to hit? Anything you think I should dive in and explain? Thoughts, comments, concerns?
Well, so Wooten caught him the big bag day two, and his final day was mostly a frog, right?
Yes. Dude, it was, like, legit pretty exciting, too, right? He kept telling me, oh, I'm punching. I'm getting my big bites punching. Well, he caught literally all his fish on the final day on a frog. He caught, I think, two of them punching on the second day, or one of them punching on the second day.
Oh, okay.
So, like, he really wanted to be getting his big bites punching, I think. And, like, that's what his dream was. But that was not what the reality was. The reality was, like, he had figured out a frog retrieve that was different than, like, standard.
This is what I'm into right here.
He was basically just fishing it fast, you know, like a popping frog, you know, pretty fast, like pretty aggressive, not like extraordinarily fast, right? Like, this is not, you would not sit and be like, oh my God, what is happening, right? He was just fishing it fast.
Yeah,
it
he's not speed reeling it across the surface.
Yeah, it's not skipping its way in. He's not, like, giving it, like, 3-foot-long chugs with his rod tip or anything like that. Like, it's not wild. But also, if you did it all day, you'd get pretty tired. You know what I mean? Like, it was not your kind of usual bloop, bloop, bloop with a frog. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So, he figured that retrieve out, And I guess he's caught him like that with that style of retrieve before, and it was like markedly better. On the final day, David Williams, the co-angler, not the
human highlight reel,
North Carolina.
Yep.
Pro, not the pro, but David Williams was fishing behind him, and he won the tournament, and he caught all his fish on a frog, and like David Williams is like kind of a notably good frog angler on the Potomac. He said that it was the first day that his pros ever outfished him on a frog.
Wow.
Which like is kind of saying a lot.
Yeah, for because, real.
Well, like David Williams has fished a lot on the Potomac. So anyway, like just the fact that he figured out something that was like better than whatever Dave Williams was doing, it's like pretty cool.
Wow, yeah, no kidding.
So anyway, that was it. He was not fishing anything extraordinary from an area standpoint. He caught most of his fish right exactly where Michael Neal caught most of his fish in the Pro Circuit event. And then he caught some other fish down near Chickamauxin. Like, as is usually the case on the Potomac, nobody finds anything new.
Yep.
It's just a matter of being in the right place at the right week. And a lot of times, you know, you kind of have a presentation or something a little bit different. At least that's what it seems like on the Potomac anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a good assessment of it.
It is worth talking about Dixon a little bit, I think, in
yeah,
a second.
Dixon led days one and two, correct?
Yeah. I thought there was a pretty good chance he would win the tournament. Obviously, if he'd done just a little bit better on day three, he would have. He ended up, I think, weighing in a couple of spinnerbait fish on the final day. On day two, he caught all his fish punching with a 2-ounce weight. On day one, he caught a bunch of fish on a spinnerbait, then culled them all out punching. He was mostly fishing near Aquia, but he was fishing like some other areas as well. He was punching stargrass, and it was interesting to me that he basically said there were a few things that I noted, and I put them both in top 10 patterns. I kind of want your opinion on these. One, he was never punching in the holes. He would always just punch to basically the thickest part of the cover, either the middle of the clump or like the edge of a hole, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And he was, when he would punch, like he would really punch high. Like he would flip that weight up and it would go up and it would come down. He was not just slipping it in.
Must have been some thick stuff if he had to do that with a 2-ouncer. You know, like that's some serious mat.
Yeah. I think some of it was just that stargrass does grow really thick, but I think some of that might have been like just kind of how he likes to punch. It might even have been helping him trigger some bites. I wouldn't guarantee it, but the other thing he said was that if you saw a small bass, like fry or like 4-inchers, like little bass in an area, that would bode really well for there being big ones in the area.
Hmm.
Which I don't know exactly how that makes sense, but maybe like, let's say there's a bunch of 12-inchers in the area. Maybe they either eat those little ones or run them out. Maybe the bigger ones don't really bother them. I don't know. That was an intriguing little thing to me because especially the first 2 days, he really looked like he was on cruise control, and he was catching like pretty good quality, seemingly pretty easily.
Interesting.
But anyhow, I guess that's that. Was there anything else that sort of stuck out to you? I want to talk about AOI in a second here.
I don't think, I think from the standpoint, like, it was interesting how well the grass had grown up, but we kind of knew the grass was doing really well when we were there in June, you know, for the pro circuit. So wasn't super shocking from afar seeing how guys were catching them. But I thought it was, I thought some of the top 10 were cool. Some of the guys that made the top 10 and like Matt Becker, which then I'll hand it off to you for talking about.
Yeah, well, hey, so Matt Becker won AOI.
He did.
In case you're wondering.
He held it together on the river.
More than held. I mean, he didn't hold it together the final day. He caught one keeper on the final day. But prior to that, he could have won this tournament. Like, if he had not just totally blown it the final day, he could have won. Because he was in third place, I think. He was maybe second, probably third. He wasn't that far back. I mean, he was there, which is pretty cool. And yeah, he caught him on the river. He mostly caught him punching too. He beat Brian Thrift, who fished with no practice in the tournament. He just got there. Came straight over from St. Clair, finished 27th, got the last check. Which maybe Brian Thrift is good. I'm starting to think that may be the case.
He is okay. He is okay.
Also, I got to watch Thrift smoke him on a topwater for 20 minutes on day one, which was pretty fun.
Cool.
That was a tournament highlight for me, no doubt. But anyway, yeah, Becker won AOI. It's his first Northern Division Angler of the Year title. I suspect not his last, as long as he keeps fishing them, because he's got those smallmouth pretty well dialed in, and the Johnstons don't fish too many of them anymore. So, turnover is kind of a feature of the Northern Division.
Yes. Yes.
It didn't used to be. It used to be just Corey and Chris just took turns.
A Johnston, yep.
Yeah. But turnover's a thing now. Nick Hatfield, our boy, finished in third, probably fishing the pro circuit next year. From Tennessee, as a side note, I don't think he'd ever been to the St. Lawrence. I think he'd been to the Potomac, maybe once, maybe never. He'd been to Champlain, once.
Boy, heck of a year.
Are you hearing Mom, just hammering on stuff on the back?
Someone's going to town.
Yeah. Apparently the hammering is done. It was a part of a class.
Ah.
Yeah, but definitely hammering.
Definitely hammering, yes.
Anyway, our boy Nick Hatfield finished third, qualified for the pro circuit. Pretty sure he is going to fish, which I'm hyped about. I don't think had ever been to the Potomac. I'm pretty sure had not ever been to the St. Lawrence. And had been to Champlain once before and pulled out a top three finish. Pretty strong stuff.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. 10 points behind Brian Thrift, right up there with Becker. It's pretty awesome. Robbie LaFear finished fourth, also qualified for the pro circuit. I'm not 100% sure if he's going to accept it or not. He's super young. I think he's 21, maybe 20. Robbie LaFear is a baby. But he's had two pretty good years in the Northern Division, and it wouldn't shock me if he moves up, which would be pretty cool to see, because I like him. I like his dad a lot. His dad comes and hangs out at weigh-in a lot. I talk to him most every tournament day, just because he's there. It'd be cool. And then Marty Robinson finished fifth, which I guess is not necessarily news, but hey, maybe he'll fish the pro circuit next year.
Hey, maybe.
Also, Martin Villa finished sixth. I think, in my head, based on how the qualification stuff works, I think they could drop down to him. They could probably drop down to Iaconelli in eighth. I don't know if Mike Iaconelli is going to fish the pro circuit next year. We'll see. Martin Villa would be interesting if he did, because he seems to be a really naturally gifted fisherman. And he doesn't like the idea of 2 days of practice. He likes 3 days of practice or more. He wants to have a full week of fishing if he's going to go travel.
Oh, sure.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Because he has to take time off from work, and take time off from work and drive, fish 2 days, have a day off, fish 2 days, then maybe drive home. That's not his idea of a good time.
Makes sense.
Which I get. But if he did fish, I think he could be pretty interesting, because he's low-key looks really good these last few years. So anyway, that's kind of our breakdown of the top 10. Jonathan Dietz finished 11th, so I don't think he's eligible for a call, which, assuming that I'm correct about that, is kind of gutting for him, because he had such a great year last year. He has a new boat this year, and I was really pulling for him, because he is super young and super good. Kyle, do you think we should move on to Havasu, or is that pretty much, or do you have any other Northern Division notes you want to hit on?
No, man, as much as I love the Northern Division, I think it's time to turn our attention to the Western Division, which is also wrapping down. It's happening currently, like as we speak.
And we have no idea what time it is.
We are completely thrown for a loop with this whole mountain time. And it's been a hot mess trying to keep tabs on it. But point is, while we're recording, it's Friday, it's day two on Lake Havasu, which, like I said, is the final Western Division event for the Toyota Series. After day one, Mike Williams is leading. He caught 20 pounds, 9 ounces. Right behind him, just a pound back, Andrew Loberg, 19 pounds, 9 ounces. Roy Hawk in third with 17 pounds. Randy McAbee's in fourth, 16-6. He's coming off of, I should say, Loberg coming off of the win at the Delta. McAbee coming off of top 10 at the Delta. Logan Huntsey, fifth, 16 pounds, coming off a win at the Delta back in, like, May. Because, I guess, for the folks listening, if you haven't followed the Western Division, it's been two California Delta. Yeah, two Delta events, and now Havasu to close things out. So, Havasu, a little tough. Like, if you scroll down the standings, not a lot of limits.
I would say it's more than a little tough.
But that upper end, definitely... I think showing out a little better than maybe I thought it would. I don't know what I thought. I've only ever covered Havasu, like February, Marchy Havasu tournaments.
Yeah, I've only ever been there in the spring. We've only, like the, you know, the Toyota Series ever been there in the spring. So yeah, I didn't really know what to expect. All I thought was like, oh, well, they're definitely going to catch them off all those cribs and stuff. Like, they'll be out in those like man-made habitat things. And turns out they are.
Yeah, it turns out they eat a crankbait really well.
Yeah, this is shocking stuff. I will say, I was hoping for like something weird and like super deep and Western. You know, it's not like, I know Havasu's not meat or whatever, but like, I thought it'd be cool if like guys were catching fish, you know, in 100 feet of water or something like that.
Yeah.
Which, you know, like big schools of bait or something, like, which I'm pretty sure they're not doing, or at least we don't know about it yet.
Yeah, no one yet that we know of is doing that.
It does seem like it is essential to kneel in order to either reel and slash or land a fish there, based on Loberg and Williams and their photos today. But, you know, other than that, yeah, it just, I don't want to say it seems like a typical Havasu tournament, and I kind of want to have, you know, one of these Havasu guys on to kind of explain it a little bit, maybe after the tournament. Maybe that's Roy Hawk. Maybe that's whoever wins. Maybe Roy Hawk wins.
Hey, maybe.
I mean, honestly, like, I feel like he's kind of due for a win out there. Like, he's come close a lot, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So I'd be down for that. Yeah, I guess we'll see.
We will see. We should also mention Angler of the Year in the Western Division, Philip Dutra, leading coming into Havasu. He finished second at the first Delta event in May, finished fifth on the Delta in August. That after day one, he's in like 12th, 13th, 12th. So, you know, really, really gunning for AOI.
Yeah, and supposedly Dutra, I guess regardless of if he wins AOY, if he qualifies, which he will, he, for the pro circuit, is planning on moving to Guntersville and doing the pro thing, which would be kind of cool.
Dutra, he's all in, and at this point, could lock up AOY, but like you said, either way, he's going to finish high enough to qualify.
I guess we should probably talk about St. Clair. Trombley and I kind of discussed it a little bit. So I think the main thing that you and I need to do is congratulate Michael Neal.
Real deal Michael Neal, man. Applause.
Dude won AOI, and then he just went out and like actually got a win. And I know people like me will say that it was actually a one-day tournament, so it's not that different from a BFL, which he's won before. But, I mean, dude. He crushed it. He, like, crushed basically the entire tournament. Like,
oh, he's straight.
It seems like a lot of times, like, those guys who, like, day one, day two, they just blow it out. Like, they don't end up winning, and that was not the case for him. He pretty much just, you know, threw it on cruise control, like, real early and just blew everyone away.
Yeah, 168 pounds, 11 ounces was his final day weight. Second place was Elton Jones Jr., who had 92 pounds, 9 ounces. So, I mean, straight walloped him. And really, by the time, I think it was like midway through the second period, was when he was really starting to crush him. You could kind of tell he knew, like, I think I'm going to win. Like, he had this kind of little fun, relaxed vibe about him, which Michael Neal does not put off. That is not a Michael Neal trait.
Yeah, his trait is, like, morose. I mean, definitely relaxed, but...
Usually
lacking too much of the fun side of things.
Yeah, maybe like, he just looks... He's got kind of, like, a resting, grumpy face. Though he may be in a really good mood, it's just...
I mean, we're making fun of him, but we are very... This podcast is a pro-Michael Neal podcast.
Very pro-Michael Neal.
Although I personally would like him to go back to a bullet. That's just me.
Michael, we need you to have a faster boat. That's what we need.
Yes, please. The old days were good. But yeah, I was so happy to see him win. I didn't get to... I feel like there was something else happening during the tournament. I think the Potomac was. I think, like, at the end of it, I was mostly driving. But it looked like a pretty cool tournament. We got to see some guys pop with largemouth and not sustain it, which is not a shock. And then we got to see Michael Neal crush, which was pretty dope.
And so Jacob Wheeler won AOI for the BPT. Also did not win the event, which I thought, like, oh man, Neal, you know, was crushing it so good early on when he won his qualifying round. And then Wheeler, you know, making it to the championship round two, I was like, oh man, this does not look good for Neal. This really does not look good. But hey, he just said, nope, I'm going to win this thing, and I'm going to win it very handily. So
yeah.
Mad props to you, Mr. Neal.
Kyle, do you want to do this smallmouth challenge situation we did? Do you want to give it a shot?
Sure.
All right. Shall I quiz you? Do you want us to just take it, like, as we go?
Yeah. Maybe we just, like, alternate. Like, I'll answer first, then you answer, right?
All
right.
Yeah, let's do this. I've got them all written down, so we're good to go. All right, Kyle, what is the biggest smallmouth you've ever caught?
Never actually weighed it, but it was definitely over 6.5, and it was on Lake Minnetonka.
Okay. I am... Also, well, I don't know, because I did weigh it, because I caught it. I think I caught it with Casey Smith.
Oh,
but I forget how much it weighed. I want to say it was either like it was 6-something. It might have been 6.3. What's the biggest bag of smallmouth you've caught, Kyle?
I guess this would be weighed in a tournament.
Yeah, but you know, Trombley didn't do weighed in a tournament. He just did his biggest five.
It would definitely, that's a Mille Lacs bag. And so I weighed 3. It was like a 5.5, one that was like another 5.5, and another one that was like a little under 5.75. And I caught a couple other ones that I didn't weigh. So, I mean, it'd be like over 25 and some change probably.
Yeah.
Because the other ones would have been like 4.75 probably.
I've definitely done 26, but I don't think I've done 27.
Yeah, but I don't think I've hit 27.
But none of that has been in a tournament. It's one of those things where, like, I don't specifically remember because I didn't write it down. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I took a picture of the scale at the end of the day.
I weighed like my buddy Andy Walls and I weighed like 24 and some change on Pekegama once in a team tournament. So it's like tournament wise, it was 24 or something.
Not this spring, but last spring, my best day was literally my first day on the water in the spring, and I didn't have my scale with me, and I caught one that after I caught some other 6-pounders later in the year, I was pretty sure was a six. So I would have had a six and then like a bunch of other really big ones. So that it was either that one or it was one that I documented that same spring that also had a six. It had like a six and like a couple high five, like a couple upper fives, you know? And then like small being like a 4.9.
Right, right. A tiny one.
So, you know, good things happen, man. Smallmouth, I love them.
Gosh, they are the best.
All right, what's your favorite time of year to smallmouth fish?
Oh, fall, absolutely.
I'm pretty sure mine's the spring.
Yeah. I mean, the spring is really fun, but I love the fall.
And maybe there's a difference between fall and winter, but to me it seems like in the spring, like, they can move around a little, like, pre-spawn. Like, they can move a little bit more, mm-hmm. and, like, they can... Things can kind of change a little. Whereas in the fall, you get to a point where when it gets to be like really wintry fall, it's just the same thing every time.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I can. Yeah. That'd probably be like late fall.
Yeah. But like October, November, like when it's still nice, like nice-ish. I mean, that's fantastic. You
know? Like water temps in the fall, like 57 to like 48.
What's your favorite smallmouth technique?
Oh, like just in general for fun, topwater. Like throwing a spook or a some sort of like walking bait or something. Oh my gosh. But also probably a swim bait, which probably correlates to why I like the fall so much, because they really eat like a 4-inch plus swim bait really good.
Yeah. I think it's a swim bait for me too. For sure. I also, that's the same thing that Trombley said. So we've got a we've got some consensus building there.
Nice.
There's something about how they eat it. You know what I mean? Like
it is. It's so awesome.
Swim bait eat is so special. What is your favorite fishery? No. Ooh. Yeah. Favorite. Well, sorry. Yeah. What's your favorite fishery? We did favorite technique.
Favorite fishery. I'm going to say Pakegama.
Okay.
In northern Minnesota.
I am gonna go Champlain.
Classic.
Purely because it has so much variety.
Yeah. Yep.
And it's really good.
Yeah, Pakegama, you can catch them. It's got smelt in it. So you can catch them like schooling over super deep water, like on a top water or like on a fluke. And you can catch them real shallow on some of the big sand flats. You can catch them in weeds. You can catch them. Deep structure, like it's a really fun place to fish.
Sounds excellent.
yeah, it's sweet.
I should go sometime.
Yeah, bring that boat over here. Let's roll.
All right. What is the worst smallmouth bait?
You know, when I texted that to you the other day, I didn't really think about it a whole lot, and I think it's a really great question. I'm gonna go with. Oh, man. Personally for me, the worst smallmouth bait is a crankbait because I never throw it.
See, for me, it's a tube because they suck. Every time I hook a fish on a tube, you know what I do? It's a 4-pounder and I lose it.
Oh.
If I hooked it on a drop shot, I would have got it in the boat.
Yeah, I shouldn't say I never throw a crankbait, but I definitely don't do it a lot. And, you know, I guess we've spoke about this recently on here, but yeah, I don't know, man. It just seems stupid.
I think those are good answers for both of us. I think we're crushing it. Tell me about a lost fish that you remember.
I lost a smallmouth on a Woman Lake one time that I do not know how big it was, but I had caught a 5 right before it, and it was substantially larger. Woman is a lake in Minnesota that like a lot of people think has the next state record in it. And it was actually on, it was on a swim bait, believe it or not. And the thing ate like very end of the cast. And I remember leaning into it and I was like, man, you know, is it like a walleye or something? Cause it was just like heavy for a little bit. Right. And then of course it started coming straight up. This is in like 20 feet of water. And, things coming straight up, jumps, just a big dark blob, right? somersaulting around. I'm like, oh my gosh. And then it starts bum rushing me, and I'm reeling and reeling and reeling and reeling and reeling and reeling. And it like just got into sight in front of the boat. And the lake's, it gets kind of like a kind of a green tint to it, like a little algae, but it's a clear lake, if that makes sense. So you could see, like in the spring, you can see, I don't know, 15 feet down. In the summer, which is when it was, you could see like 5-7 feet down, you know, like it gets diminished. And basically the smallmouth swam straight at the boat to the point where like I could just see the swim bait sticking out of the front of its mouth, and I could see the thing's head, and it's coming at me, and the swim bait just popped out, and the thing swam straight down, and the swim bait came shooting up at me, and I was like, I don't know what happened, nor how did it made it through that first jump, but that was maybe the biggest smallmouth I've ever had on. Of course it was, right? I lost it, but I mean, it was a giant smallmouth, and yeah, I dumped it. Should have been reeling faster. I should have Ike and Ellie'd it and like ran to the back of the boat or something, but that thing decided it was coming at me, and it was not stopping. It was in full charge mode.
When you said giant smallmouth, that was an excellent zona, I just want to say. I don't know if you were going for that, but you did a pretty good job.
It came out, man. I just got excited. Gosh.
So I was fishing a Bassmaster Open on Champlain, like what? 3-4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I broke down on the ride up to my first spot, and I was on 100 trolling back to Plattsburgh going to get my motor fixed, and probably 10 minutes into this troll, I'm like, literally, this is pre-Ultrex, so I'm on a 4-trex on 100 having to steer the whole way. It's the dumbest thing ever. Like, God, I can't believe I had to steer. But anyway, I'm just like winding a Kitech around because why not, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one eats it right near the boat, and it's huge. Like, it's at least a 4-pounder, maybe bigger. I caught like almost a 5-pounder later that same day, which is what makes this particularly excruciating. But anyway, eats it like right next to the boat. I'm not super ready for it. Eats it, pulls, breaks me off. Literally, like, it's one of the only smallmouth I've ever had, like, actually break the line. Because
wow.
I was on 100, it was on 100, and the drag was apparently not. And just ate it, I hooked it, I tripled the rod over, and it came off.
Gosh. That's a great line, though. I was on 100. It was on 100.
Dude, it was. There was.
It's not a good scenario with the smallmouth when they're on 100 and you're also.
Yeah, like moving when you're going opposite directions, that's not what you want.
Like if a largemouth was at 100, I mean, it's really going like. It's like 20%, you know? Yeah. Like you would have caught that largemouth, I guess is what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like guaranteed. Largemouth, yeah. No problem. I don't know if I landed that fish. Like, I don't know if I would have got a check. I definitely didn't get a check without that fish. Let's put it that way.
Ooh.
But I super... Yeah, it just sticks out to me. Because, like, I've lost some topwater fish. But, you know, that one in a tournament like that, like... All right. What is the best underrated small... No. What is the best smallmouth angler? Who is the best smallmouth angler?
Oh gosh. Man.
You knew about these questions.
I know, and I didn't even really think about it. I'm going to say I really want to give the nod to Dobber because I feel like every time I watch him smallmouth fish or he's around smallmouth, I'm like, "Dang." But I feel like I should give the nod to a Johnston too because they're pretty good at catching smallmouths.
What about Kevin Van Dam?
Kevin Van Dam is also really good, but I'm gonna go.
Kevin Van Dam is also really good, but we're not considering him for this exercise.
I don't know, man. I feel like Dobson, tournament wise, across most of the major smallmouth fisheries. Tends to hold zone pretty well.
Yeah. All season. He's an all-season angler,
Yeah.
He catches them in a ton of places.
Yeah, like that's why I think I got to go with Scott Dobson.
What do you think about Jacob Wheeler as the answer for this?
Honestly? Yeah. I think you absolutely could make that case.
Because that's what Trombley said. And I think he might be right.
I 100% would be down for that as an answer.
But also, I'm going to go ahead and I'm just going to take Chris Johnston. Because, like, did you see what he did at Messina? The fact that he broke 75 pounds a day, like, blew past it, running 5 hours a day to go catch his fish?
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
Whew, baby.
That's pretty wild.
Like, it really just, if you look at what Corey did when he won the Bass Open out of Clayton, and then you, like, juxtapose what Chris was doing to that, and you're like, holy smokes. And, like, it's not like those guys, you know, the Johnstons, don't catch them other places. They crush them on Champlain. They've caught them really good on Erie. Like, they crush them on Simcoe. I mean, I'll take Chris. I don't know that. I think that there are, like, I think if you swap, I think there's a very good chance that if you swapped, like, Chris and Dobson back and forth between the Thousand Islands and St. Clair for, like, a month fishing tournaments against each other, they'd end up, like, even, though. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
What's the best underrated smallmouth bait?
Ooh. So, like, real specific, I would say a Rapala skitter prop.
Whoa, that is super specific.
Yeah. It's, like, one of my favorite smallmouth topwaters. Like, river, lake, doesn't matter.
I think that a square bill is probably
one
of the best underrated smallmouth baits.
Sure. Especially because ones made with toenails for a bill.
Yeah, obviously. Everybody watch Matt Steffens.
Yeah, go to Matt Steffens'
most recent
YouTube page
at this point, but watch one of his YouTube videos. It's probably disgusting.
Yeah.
Let's see. I just feel like it is good in a river, and then there's a window in the spring where I don't, like, you can crush them on the right crankbait. And maybe it's not a square bill, but, like, maybe it's a medium runner or something. Like, I think it happens all through the Great Lakes on Champlain. Like, that pre-spawn time, like, dude, it can be really incredible.
Yeah. Yeah,
I like
that.
And I don't think it's not something that anyone's like, oh, yeah, you got to have a square bill for smallmouth. Like,
right.
When you think about cranking for smallmouth, you think about the open water thing, and that's mainly what you think about.
Yeah. Yep. No, that's a good one. I like that.
All right, I have what leader knot do you use in here? And I added it only because Trombley uses a swivel.
Oh, nice.
Which blew me away. So,
yeah.
Kyle,
wow.
What's your leader knot?
I used to be an Alberto guy forever, but now that I don't fish as much and I got more time to sit in my little tackle room, I feel confident in an FG. So that's like, I'm looking over here at a couple of my spinning rods. All of those got FGs on them right now.
I used to be an Alberto guy. I am making the change to FG, I believe. I think that it's been accomplished.
Nice.
I threw it the whole time. I threw an FG the entire time at the St. Lawrence.
With complete faith.
I mean, I tied like 4 spinning rods up. I tied an FG on, and I went and fished a tournament. So, yeah.
Boom.
That's
a win.
I don't know if I'm going to tie it on the water or if I need to, something like that. But, and I also need to experiment with some more line sizes and things. I've only tied it on 8-pound test.
Oh, but, okay.
You know, theoretically, I'm on the FG train now.
Nice.
And then finally, what is the lightest line and the heaviest line you've caught a smallmouth on? And remember that sometimes, like, braid and top waters exist. Just throwing that out there.
Yep. So 2-pound test, lightest.
Oh yeah.
Just through the ice. And heaviest would be 65 pound cord.
I would say the heaviest for me is probably 50. And I think the heaviest, like mono or fluoro I've caught them on is 25.
Yep. 25 would be the same for me. Yep.
And then I think the lightest for me is 5. I can't say with confidence I've caught one on 4 from like ice fishing. So 5 for sure.
And 5's plenty strong too.
Yeah, especially the 5 pound, like the 5 pound gamma is like, I probably not actually 5 pound.
Oh yeah.
It's like pretty strong stuff. Very thin, but like wicked strong, like kind of stiff too.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I've caught like a ton on 6 pound, so I don't know if that. I don't have anything super impressive like 2 pound test. That's pretty rad.
It definitely took a little while to get in.
Was that on purpose or not?
Yes. There are, I don't smallmouth fish a lot through the ice, but there are times that I've targeted them, and there are times they are the grumpiest little fish on the planet because it's cold and there's ice over their head. And they'll only eat like little panfish, like little tiny tungsten jigs with like a plastic, like a little tiny plastic tipped on it. And that's what that rod had, that 2 pound test.
There you go. All right, well, Kyle, we're done with our smallmouth quiz.
That was fun.
It is. We could devise one for largemouth, but I just think inherently it wouldn't be as fun.
No, but we could probably come up with some questions that would maybe make it as fun. Maybe we'll try to work that in a later episode.
Do you want to sell us some stuff, Kyle? Because now is the time.
Yeah, I do. Few lures have stood the test of time like the original Rattle Trap by Bill Lewis, and now, with the help of Major League Fishing Pro Mark Daniels Jr., we're launching the SB57 and MR6. Go to rattletrap.com to learn more. And, are you in need of a great career opportunity that gives you time to fish and spend time with your family? Neat Companies is looking for you. Neat needs Class A CDL drivers now. Competitive pay, 100% paid health insurance, 401k, tuition reimbursement, and more are just some of the benefits. Call Neat now at 833-463-NEAT to get your career started. That's 833-463-NEAT.
Kyle, we did it.
We made it.
We actually had a podcast in the month of September. This
we made
is huge
it.
For us.
Congratulations, boys.
Anyhow, I don't really have anything else, man. I think that feel like between you and I, we've now been on the phone for about 2 hours. I think we're in good shape.
I think we are too, man. I think we are.
All right. Well, folks, MajorLeagueFishing.com has a whole variety of things on it. You should go there, check it out, see what you like, see what you don't like. If you don't like something there, tell us about it. And you can do that at a podcast at MajorLeagueFishing.com. It's an email address. I guess, Kyle, you are on Instagram. It's Kyle Lumber. I'm there. It's Jody Blanco. I don't really have any, like, live to go plug or anything. So, I guess, have fun.
Yeah. And, you know, everyone, I hope you get out, crush some fish. Maybe it's hunting season. You're starting to do some of that. Get after it. And until next time, see ya.